this off? Are we recording? Okay. So, welcome. This is a Mike Forsyth episode. What we're doing is asking guys in our network and partnership and friendships that have a prepared lifestyle and guys who think about the idea of being better prepared, might even come from a version of that and potentially become a little complacent, so they potentially don't live that lifestyle. But a series of these questions is meant to identify some of the things that you do currently today versus what you did back in the military experience, and also to get your expertise. It's a line of about 10 questions. Some of them focus towards you. The first question is, what's being prepared mean to you?
Being ready to handle whatever might come at you.
I like that.
That's what it is. Right. You don't know what you're going to get into, and you got to be ready for that.
What's resilience mean to you?
I think what resilience has come to mean to me is when you are able to react quickly and rebound quickly when something goes wrong. I also feel like I feel like you got to be careful as a human of being, you know, having big sine waves in your life where you're really happy and then get really sad, and you get really like, I think it's better just to be a little bit more steady. So I don't feel like resilience is a huge part of my life, because I don't ever feel like I need to bounce back, because I, even when something goes wrong, it doesn't affect me in a big negative way. Mm. So yeah, I would say that being resilient is being able to keep going regardless of what's going on.
Mm. I like that. How do you stay resilient? I mean, the context of your example, you said basically you're steadfast and steady, so you don't have lulls of vulnerability.
Right.
How do you stay and maintain that integrity?
I think you have to be careful about when things are going good, getting too excited about it, getting too happy about it. And when things are going bad, you don't get too sad about it. I often talk about the fact, from a leadership perspective, you're in charge of a mob. And when you're in charge of a mob, when the mob starts moving in a direction, they get the mob mentality and they all start going in that direction, which means when they do something well, or an operation goes well, or a project goes well, and they all start getting happy and high-fiving, they think they can start getting a little bit arrogant. You can start getting a little bit complacent. So you as a leader has to be like, hey, yep, we did good. Here's some things we need to check on this, and let's make sure we take care of this little problem that could have happened we didn't foresee. So you kind of hold them in check. And then the opposite is true also. When things start going bad, you do a bad operation, you have a bad project, you lose a bunch of capital on an investment that you made with the team, the morale starts to go down. You can't be part of that mob. You got to be the one that says, hey, look, we learned some lessons, and we're not going to make those mistakes again, and we got more opportunity coming in the future, so let's go. So I think that just as a leader, you need to stay balanced in terms from a morale perspective, and that spreads to making sure that your team stays balanced from a morale perspective. And I think that if you have that mindset, resiliency doesn't come into play as much, because you're not falling down a bunch, because you're not putting yourself in situations where you're letting yourself get complacent. So this is probably the longest answer you've had on this question.
I apologize. It sounds like it's expectation management as well.
Yep.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So fall down, get back up. That's my short answer. Mm.
You talk about leadership. What in your opinion, I mean, you're out of all the people that I know in my entire network, but also taking a step back, I look at you as a person who understands leadership seemingly more than anybody else. Because when you look at an Admiral McRaven, it's kind of top down, right? It's a pinnacled position, and that perspective is different. Your role is like the tactical leader. I would look at Admiral McRaven, McChrystal. Mm-hmm. I'd look at those guys as like the strategic. You're the tactical, which I think for most people is tangible, useful, elements of leadership that are important. So I look at you profoundly as the subject matter expert on this, and I'm interested in your take on a couple questions on leadership. One, what in your opinion makes a good leader?
So when first of all, props to McCraven and McChrystal, those guys, you know, I don't want your setup of the question to yeah. me or you being implying like, oh, those guys are, they're okay at a strategic level, but no, those guys are great. You know, I'm friends with Admiral McCraven. I worked for Admiral McCraven. Great respect for him. I never worked directly for McChrystal, but I knew him. And I was lucky enough to be in situations where I was getting a very good view of the strategic picture. I was working for Admiral McGuire. I was his aide for 13 months or something like that. And so I'm sitting in meetings with all those guys. Got to see a very good perspective. It was very helpful to me to understand, and I just did a podcast about this, to understand the negative impact it had when SEALs did dumb shit, when they would make mistakes, when they would do things that they shouldn't be doing. And I got to see, you know, my boss on the phone with, you know, with the CNO, with the Secretary of the Navy, and with just sitting there with, you know, with the SOCOM commander, and realizing, hey, that you get some E5 out there that does something stupid, it has a negative impact up the entire chain of command. So community is not that big. And when I saw that, it helped me see that perspective, understand that perspective, and then that pass that perspective on to the guys that worked with me at a tactical level. So I feel like I was lucky in the fact that I got to see that strategic picture and I got to understand it pretty well. And then I had a very lucky career of being a prior enlisted guy, working in the training department, doing a bunch of platoons, and getting a good handle on the tactical side of thing, teaching all those things. Back in the day when you could teach everything, you know, we used to teach when I was in training cell at SEAL Team 1 as an E5, I taught everything, land warfare, CQC, combat swimmer, you name it. Like, I was going on that trip, spec recon, comms, everything. So I was very lucky to have a good tactical handle as well. And I think that really benefited, made life a little bit easier for me. But what makes a good leader? For me, the number one thing that I always talk about when it comes to the most important characteristic for leadership is humility. Because if you're not humble, you're not listening to anybody else, you think you know everything, you're not taking any input, you're probably getting complacent, you probably aren't respecting your enemy. And all those things stem from a lack of humility, and that ego getting out of control is the biggest problem that leaders run into.
Interesting. You've been noted as being a good leader. I assume being a good leader means the majority of your decisions were good ones when weighed against bad. Out of all the decisions that you've made, is there any decision that's a bad one that stands out to you as a lesson learned that's valuable both in your profession and your personal life?
I'm trying to think of which example I should use of bad decisions. You know, in the book Extreme Ownership, I wrote about having a blue-on-blue fratricide. And we spent a bunch of time. We had a bunch of operations that we were doing back-to-back. It was supposed to be a battalion-sized operation that we were supporting. The division said no battalion-sized operations. And so the battalion-sized operation, which had one con ops written for it, which we had written one con ops for, got broken up into, I think it was 11 company plus-sized operations, which therefore I had to then go and write 11 concept of operations separately. These were about 10-page documents. You know, some of it was copy-paste, but there was a lot of detail that went into them. You know, even if it's just what buildings do you think you're going to be in, and these had to be, instead of just being like using the battle map, they were grid zones. Like, it was detail that was a pain. And I just said, okay, we'll do it. And we spent too much time on this paperwork and not enough time rehearsing and not enough time sitting in the briefs with the Army. And the Army was, you know, the first of the 506th, the most squared away group of people I've ever known. And we spent, I spent too much time with the paperwork, and I should have spent more time coordinating, sitting in those meetings, making sure that everyone understood what was happening. And we ended up having a fratricide. We ended up having an Iraqi soldier get killed, having one of my guys get wounded, having several other friendly Iraqi soldiers get wounded. So that was one of those ones where I look back and think, yep, you leaned a little bit too hard in the, hey, you know what, let's just get it done. And I should have said, hey, you don't need all this information. It's the same basic con op. And I pushed back maybe once or twice with that of, hey, it's the same basic con op. We're doing the same thing. Nothing's really changed. And I should have even continued to push back when the word came down, no, just write 11 new con ops. Hey, Roger that. And I should have said, no, we don't need to. Or I should have said, hey, I'll do it all. Platoon commander, you go in there and sit in these meetings. Instead, we kind of just double teamed them. So that was, you know, I look back at that one. It would have been, it was a mistake for me to do that.
Hmm. On the topic of leadership, I'm interested on your experience. Who's the most profound leader that you've ever worked with or for?
So there was a guy that I worked for in my second SEAL platoon. He was a prior enlisted SEAL. He made it all the way up to E8 before he switched over to the enlisted side, or sorry, to the officer side. He was he'd been stationed at just about every type of SEAL team that there is to be stationed at. He was an extremely humble guy. He was good at everything. He understood us, and he was just awesome to work for. We actually had a mutiny in our platoon. We got our platoon commander fired, and this guy came in to take his place, and he was so good, and he made life so good for these, you know, 16 SEALs in his platoon. And that's the guy that, as I worked for him, when I got done working for him, I said to myself, one day, if I can, I'm going to try and make life good for 16 guys in a SEAL platoon. And that's when I decided I was going to try and become an officer. And I applied for it and got picked up. But his humility is the thing that I've always tried to emulate. The fact that he listened to us, he was the most experienced guy. He had combat experience. At a time when almost no one had combat experience, he had been in the Grenada invasion. And so he had all this experience, he'd done everything, and yet he listened to us, he asked our opinion, he would be influenced by us. He let us run things. And I thought to myself, this guy who has all this experience, the senior guy in our platoon, been in forever, knows everything, he's asking us for our opinion and actually executing on our opinion and letting us run things. That's what I need to try and do. And that's the guy that I tried to emulate through. And I still try and emulate him to this day. Just a great guy.
That's awesome. Do you know where he's at right now?
He works in the Naval Special Warfare still as a civilian.
Wow. Yep. That's awesome.
Yep. I've asked him to come on my podcast. He just smiled and said, no, thanks.
That's so awesome. Oh, that's awesome. On the topic of individual preparedness, I'm curious to what's in your everyday carry.
Well, like you, it kind of depends on what I'm doing and where I'm going. So I'm going to make an assessment on what I'm doing and where I'm going, and then I'm going to, you know, put together or pull out whatever EDC I'm going to need. You know, you were just on my podcast and I was talking about flip-flops, which is, I know I had Pat Mack was on, or he'd done something about flip-flops, and I mentioned my daughter was asking me what are things that I would not want to live without, and I had to put flip-flops in there because I wear flip-flops all the time. But when I think about the assessment that I make of what I'm going to do and where I'm going to be, like, and I think I said on the podcast we just did, you know, if I'm going to be like 50 meters from my zone, which is either my vehicle or my gym or my house, I'm not wearing flip-flops. Like I've even said on that podcast, like you can't gut through some sprint across the gravel and then do anything, right? You can get to your, I can get to my gym where I know I'm going to be good to go. I get to my house where I know I'm going to be good to go. I get to my vehicle. I can gut through that for 50 meters. But if I'm anywhere that's going to be longer than that, well, now I'm making adjustments and I'm just wearing a pair of sneakers, you know, no big deal. And that's kind of the assessment that I make with anything. But, you know, I have the standard kind of loadout, you know, the standard kind of loadout that I'll carry. That's, I guess, would be similar to what normal dudes carry. Mm-hmm. You know, I carry a 365, you know, tourniquet, flashlight. I like a headlamp. That's kind of how I roll.
Hmm. What about on the topic of mobility? Now, it's not common for people to understand mobility in the context of preparedness, but we look at mobility platforms as the extension of a capacity. You know, it's like a rucksack with more space. What is your preferred mobility platform, or what vehicle do you utilize and why?
I have a four-wheel drive Sprinter van.
Oh, you do?
Yep.
Oh, I have one of those.
Yeah.
Why did you choose the Sprinter van?
Well, when I got mine, there was no other available options. I've had four-wheel drive vans. I've probably had, let me think, one, two, three. If you count my 1997 Dodge Grand Caravan was an all-wheel drive vehicle. I don't get vehicles that are all-wheel drive. Mm. That to me, that just doesn't make sense in the world. But if you count that one, I probably had 5 four-wheel drive vans.
Did you have was it black with a red stripe going?
I've often been tempted for that. But like I've had the Quigley vans. I've had the Chevy when the Chevy made an all-wheel drive van. I've had one of those. I had another one that was just modded up in Utah. And then I've had 2 Sprinter four-wheel drive vans that came out in 2016. I got them the first year that they came out. So to me, that is a great mobility platform. So you have one, you know that they're extremely capable, you know that you can put anything that you need in them. They're just great vehicles. Now Ford has come out with an all-wheel drive version, so I'll be looking at that one as well. I'm reading good things about it. It's gas, not diesel. Some advantages, disadvantages. You know, I'm actually kind of leaning towards gas these days, just because you get in the cold weather. Depending on how cold it is, you can get problems with diesel, and those are problems that you can solve as well. You know, there's preparedness that you can do for that, but I'm definitely looking at one of those Ford vans right now. But yes, that's my mobility platform.
It's awesome.
Full size four wheel drive Sprinter van.
It's also a mobile sniper hide too. It's great sniper hide.
It's great for everything.
Loophole shots. You can do all the stuff in there.
You can survive for a long time with one of those vehicles.
I heard you on the topic of homestead discuss a little bit about your situation, where you described your kitchen being essentially an observation post. I think you described your kitchen as an OP, overwatching certain parts of your property. Without going into detail, without compromising your personal security, what are some of the things that you focused on building and securing your homestead?
It's just a compound.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Talk people through compound context, because we know compound because we've operated in and out of compounds. We've actually seen the advantages and disadvantages from the enemy side. Compounds aren't common in America. What is a compound, and what methodology did you apply?
It's a walled compound that if you're going to come in, I'm going to know. And it's not going to be easy for you to get in there. There's also, you know, I've explained this to when I had people doing work at my house, and they'd say, well, if somebody wants to get through this, and I'm like, yeah, that's true, I'm going to know, number one. And number two, it's going to be a challenge. And number three, I'm going to know that they're bad. Like if you're entering my compound, I know that you are doing it because you want to do something nefarious to me and my family.
It's not an accident.
Yeah, it's not. You didn't just wander in there. So that's going to be a problem for you if you show up there. And, you know, that's good visibility on the points of entry. And yeah, it's a nice place.
I like how you describe that. That's a perfect prepper answer. Yeah, it's the homes. You know, I got this thing going. Do you do anything in your homestead for sustaining your survivability long term? Do you have bees? Do you have chickens? Do you have any renewable energy sources? What name, if any, any of the things that you have that extend your survivability long term?
Yeah, I have solar at my house.
Oh, awesome!
And I have a lot of meat that's frozen. That is a serious problem if you have frozen meat and you don't have an energy source for it. So I have solar that can power my refrigerator, my freezers, my deep chest freezers for a long period of time.
Awesome. What's the number one thing you would recommend for somebody who wants to live a more prepared lifestyle as a start point? Is it jiu-jitsu, hunting?
I always recommend jiu-jitsu to everyone for all reasons. and definitely, you know, no doubt, you know, it's very important to know how to defend yourself. It's really great for your physical activity. It's really good for your confidence. It's really good for meeting cool people that are into this, at least one thing that you're into. So yeah, train jiu-jitsu if you can train jiu-jitsu for sure. I think, you know, just doing the podcast and reading your book, and then the conversation that you and I had today, there's a level of understanding that you and I we grew up in, because you and I both entered the military at a young age, both went into special operations at a very young age. That was my whole adult life. And so what I realize in your book is that, and what you realized, I didn't really think about it the way you did. You realized that we have this and most people don't. You realize that, like, you and I can pick up a pistol and we can shoot. We can shoot. You and I can see a combat trauma situation and we know how to stop the bleeding. We know how to clear the airway. We just know that. I never really thought about it. And you realized, hey, that's not normal. It's not normal to be able to do that. It's not normal, even talking with you today. Like, when I'm walking down the street, I look for what's cover, what's concealment, where is it at? If I get contacted from over there, it's not, and I'm not, I know, I understand, I don't think I'm crazy, because I know it sounds crazy when I say this stuff. And I think when people are crazy, it's when they don't realize how crazy they sound. So I realize I sound crazy. But when I walk down the street and I look around and think, oh, like there's a concrete wall over there that I could easily get behind if there's fire from that direction. Like, those are just normal thoughts. And I think that you and I grew up where we have these thoughts to us are normal. And I don't think a lot of people think like that. Mm. So I think starting to think about these things in all aspects of your life is extremely important. And I think if you are going to be more prepared, I think it's to just simply start thinking more about being prepared than you do right now. Most people aren't thinking about that. You and I, at least, well, maybe I can't speak for you on this, but you run out of water before in the field? Have you ever run out of the water before in the field?
Yeah.
Have you ever been lost in the field?
Yeah.
Have you ever had some of your machine gunners go Winchester in the field?
Yep.
You know, like, these are things where we had those things happen to us and never want to have them happen again. Mm-hmm. Most people don't have that benefit. You know, like, you've seen guys get shot. You've recognized the medics saving their lives. So seeing these things and being in these situations, I think, is very beneficial, and it makes us think that way. Whereas in many cases, I think civilians don't. And listen, man, it's 1% of the population. I don't hold anything against people that didn't join the military. Good for you. Go and do something else. But you, unfortunately, didn't get this training. That's all it is training. And so I think getting involved in it, thinking about it, the training piece, this is something that I spent a lot of time doing. I spent a lot of time training people how to handle stressful situations. Putting them in stressful situations, you can get better at it. I got to see over and over again individuals that would go from panic, frozen, disaster, not being able to make a decision, not being able to move, to totally competent leaders. Mm. making things happen. That's a transition that anybody can make. It's a transition that takes time. It takes training. It takes effort. Some people are going to be naturally better at it than others. Some people will be naturally worse than others, but it is a skill set that you can get better at. So go and seek out those opportunities. Go and get yourself better. Go and learn. Go and be more prepared.
I love that. If given the end of days, how would you fare?
The end of days?
Yeah. Like apocalypse. Big apocalyptic scenario, civil unrest, the worst case scenario. How would you fare in your current situation?
Oh, I would be, I don't know if stoked is the right word, but I would be stoked. Maybe not stoked, but I'd be good to go.
Yeah.
I'd be very, very, we'd be rocking and rolling.
You'd be waiting your entire life for this.
You know, you don't watch Red Dawn 79 times. By the time you turn, 11 and end up not ready for Red Dawn. So,
all right, two last questions. A little personal. What is Jocko Willink most passionate about today?
Helping people out. It's truly what, otherwise I wouldn't be doing anything that I'm doing. I wouldn't be doing anything that I do. Like, I don't have any reason to do anything I'm doing anymore. But the opportunity to help people, the opportunity to help kids, I've written a bunch of kids' books. That's one of the most gratifying things is when a kid says, writes me a letter, writes me an email, sends me a message, comes by my gym and says, I did my first pull-up yesterday. I got an A on my math test, whatever. That's just awesome. Helping leaders, got a leadership company and we help leaders, we help organizations. We get to see companies transform from, whether they're losing money, whether they're barely profitable, whether they're getting by, whether they're doing well, but they get to transform into something that's outstanding with an awesome culture of leadership. That's awesome. Doing the podcast, talking through, allowing people to recognize more about history, allowing people through a podcast to understand human nature better. Because that's really essentially what my podcast boils down to is human nature. When does human nature get revealed? Human nature gets revealed in very stressful, very traumatic situations like war. And so when you read about war, when you interview people about war, you can better understand human nature. And when you're better understanding at human nature, it makes you better at everything, interacting with other humans, including leadership, making clothing in America, right? We're rebuilding manufacturing in America. That is, we got 500 employees right now that are learning a skill or exercising their skill. They're bringing manufacturing back to America, making stuff here, as opposed to actual slave labor. Like, we talk about slavery as if it was an ancient or historical thing. There's slavery right now. Slavery happening right now. And if you're buying something from China, you are literally engaging in slavery. That's what's happening. So being able to bring this stuff back to America is a passion of mine. And then, we're making supplements and energy drinks. That's truly good for you. It's kind of weird that you could make a product and sell it to kids that's poison, that kills them, that gives them diseases, and yet it's going on. So being able to help people out, that's why I'm doing this. That's what I'm doing it for. And that's what I'm going to keep doing.
Speaking of selfless service, we had talked before, or maybe I've heard you talk before, about what it would take for you to become a politician. What would it take under current circumstances for you to become a politician, especially if given the opportunity or asked for the opportunity from somebody like Tulsi Gabbard? I imagine Tulsi Gabbard is somebody who is in a position where she has a proven track record. She has history. She's a great leader and would step up at some point and potentially ask for support. Mm-hmm. And I imagine she's not going to ask for support from fellow politicians, but she might seek the support of men like yourself. What would it take for you to actually run for a political position to help this country get back on its feet?
You remember what they did to Tulsi, right?
Oh, I remember. I remember. But I also know she's resilient mm-hmm. and she's bouncing back.
You know, I I wrote a book called Leadership Strategy and Tactics. And in that book, I wrote about let me hear your take on this. You might recognize this. You might not recognize it right now, but when I explain it to you. So people talk about when to make a decision. We talked about some decision making. And one of the things that I learned to do was, if there was something happening, right? There was something going on. My platoon was stagnant, or they were, you know, losing the bubble a little bit. No one was, there's confusion. What I learned to do was, like, I want someone on my team to step up and say, hey, everyone, listen up. We're going to go strong point that building. That's what I want. No one's doing it. There's too much confusion. There's too much mayhem. I would give a couple extra seconds and let everyone feel that there's a vacuum, that everyone realizes, oh no, we don't know what's going on right now. No one's making a decision. If you step in too early, there's people that are still, they're still focused on something else. There's a guy over here and he thinks he knows what he's doing. So everyone, they're not ready for the call to be made. And sometimes you got to wait 3 extra seconds for it to go, hey, everyone, strong point that building. That's what it takes. You need that little moment of a vacuum of leadership where people are actually ready to be led. 4 seconds prior to that, they think they know what's going on. They think they have a plan. They're not open-minded about what we're going to do next. So if I look at this in like a grand scale, there's right now, everybody thinks they know what the good idea is. I mean, that's one of our problems in America right now, is everyone has such a big ego about what they think they know that they don't listen to anybody else. Mm. So to try and step into a situation where everyone actually thinks they know what they're doing, all you're going to get if you step in is a bunch of resistance, immediate resistance. Mm. So some kind of a vacuum would have to occur. Now, look, we might be pretty close right now to a vacuum. You know, when you look at the candidates that are stepping up right now, there's a lot of people going, really? Is that what we got? They said that last time around too. Really? Is that what we got? But they still got out and fought for those candidates. Mm. Still got out and said, yeah, but this is my guy. This is my guy. They still did that because they still thought they understood what was happening. Mm. So I think getting, you know, for me to try and get into the political arena, which I have no desire to do, man. I have no desire to do that at all. I don't like that scene. I don't think I have the stomach for it. I don't have any desire to do anything like that. But if there was a vacuum, an audible vacuum, that no one knew what to do, or there was such a vacuum of leadership, and I could sense it, then I might say, hey, I need to go. But I'm telling you, man, like, people say, like, isn't it bad enough? Because my standard answer is, like, it's not bad enough. When things are bad, if things were really, got really bad, I might step in. And people say, it's bad. Well, how much worse do you want it? I'm like, no, everyone still has a cell phone. Everyone still is eating, you know, like, I'm talking bad. You know, when you asked me earlier about the apocalypse, like, dude, I'm going full warlord in apocalypse. Like, we're taking over. That's no factor to me. I'm looking forward to that. That's what probably my most natural instinct is. Like, it's not to do anything else. Like, there is no better time for me than when I was just in a platoon or in charge of a task unit. That's what I was meant for. So all this other stuff, it's cool. I dig it, but that's my natural habitat.
Mm. So there's no desire, but there may be a necessity.
There may be a necessity. But boy, I hope it doesn't come to that, man.
Yeah.
I really do.
Same. I hope, but I also know, based on the direction we're headed, that we might be in a desperate need for profound leadership. And I think that's the biggest issue we're facing for the future of our country, is the lack of leadership that can get the job done. And when I look at leaders across the entire spectrum of leaders I know in every space and genre, you're on a very short list. And I know I say this, and it's like, we go back and forth, we talk about this, and it's It's people like it because it's the idea and the concept, but you're an actual leader who's capable because you understand how to lead through people, which is the profound component. Most people think the president of the United States, the figurehead, is the leader. And that's true when they are a leader. But what makes a profound president or a profound leader of this nation is a person who could lead people to lead the country. Like, one man can't do it alone. And when you look at the current situation, it's like, how much further do we have to slip to an apocalypse before? I mean, it might be too far gone, you know, like to protect the democracy at all cost. Last part of that, I'm interested because you said desire versus necessity. I wonder if you were asked by the right people to potentially step up. Like, I use Tulsi Gabbard as an example, but maybe it's not Tulsi. Maybe it's DeSantis. Maybe it's somebody who understands the stakes and they're high. And maybe it's not the highest calling as the president of the United States, but it's somewhere in the administration leading because that's what we need. I imagine if the reason I use the analogy on Glenn Beck's show using you and Tulsi Gabbard, because the key to a great leader of a nation is leading people, but also empowering the right human beings to do that job. Your network, your understanding of what good leadership is, when you take a civilian who's a political 50-year guy who doesn't understand what that is as a leader, you get problems. When you get people who are willing to step up, when asked, would that change your mind?
I love America. And I would do anything for this country. So I guess if it came down to it, I would do what was asked of me. But man, I hope it doesn't come to that. Mm. We'd be in a pretty bad place. And I don't, you know, when you say maybe we're too far gone, I get it. I get it for sure. Man, we've been through some shit, you know, like go to Gettysburg and walk that battlefield and realize that, you know, we killed hundreds of thousands of each other. Even in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, there was police officers getting executed. It was horrible. The Vietnam War just about ripped this country apart. So we've been through a lot of bad times. It seems like it's bad. Part of the reason it seems like it's bad is because we can see more now because of social media and the 24-hour news cycle. Like, you know, there's sharks off the coast of California. Mm. You know, there's a lot of them. Mm. They can see them now because we got drones out there flying around. There's big great white sharks swimming around out there. Mm. We knew that they were out there kind of, but we didn't really know it. Now we know they're out there. You can go watch them. Mm. So we're seeing a lot of that now. You travel around this country. Mm. Most of the people that I meet in this country are not crazy. Most of them are like, what are they thinking about? They're thinking about helping their family. They're thinking about building their business. They're thinking about working hard. That's what they're thinking. They're not thinking about these crazy people that you see on Twitter. They're not thinking like that. They're just good people. That's what the majority of America is. At some point, that majority of America needs to step up and we need to step up. I think I'm one of those people. I actually talked about this recently. Like, if I had a presidential or I had a party, it'd be called normal. Like, hey, I'm just a normal person over here. That's what I am, a normal person. And there's a lot of Americans that are just normal. And they're not fringe. They're just trying to raise their family, trying to build a business, trying to work hard. That's what they're trying to do. So that's where we're at. Most people are like that. Are there some fringe crazies out there? Yes, there are. Do they get a lot of airtime? Yes, they do. Do they make a lot of noise? They certainly do. Are they wrecking some cities? Sure, they are. Yeah, for sure. I live in California, man. Go to LA. It's parts of LA is third world crazy. Parts of San Francisco are third world crazy. Like, you can't imagine that this is in America, but it is. At some point, do the people of LA, the people of San Francisco, look around and say, dude, we've had enough of this shit, right? And California as a whole, you know, California is, California's farmers, man. California's farmers. It's agricultural. It's people that are out working hard every day. That's what California is. And there's a couple cities that are not like that. So I think the louder these loud elements get, and they, you know, you're in a restaurant and the one table over there, they got the loud mouse over there, and you know, you're the waiter and you're like, okay, yep, here's the beer you wanted, here you go. And then they start yelling more and they, we want French fries. So you get them the French fries and you're trying to take care of them. And eventually you say, you know what? You're freaking out of here. You're ruining this for everybody else. You're gone. I think we'll get there before we have a big bar fight. And guess what? If we have a bar fight, I'm winning.
I love that. Let's go with closing thoughts. And where can people find some of your resources for education, mentorship, and some of the things that you talked about today?
I've written a bunch of books about leadership. I have a consulting company called Echelon Front. I have a supplement company, JockoFuel.com, EchelonFront.com. OriginUSA.com. We're making everything in America, 100%, 100% in America. The source materials are from America. That's what we're doing. We don't support slavery in third world countries. That's not what we're doing. We don't support those countries, by the way. You know what they have for laws around putting pollutants into the air and in the water? They don't have any laws. So you, when you buy your whatever brand from overseas, they don't care about the earth at all, right? And they might give 1% or 3%, or they might talk a good game. They're not. So go to originusa.com. I got a podcast called Jocko Podcast, and you can find all the stuff at jocko.com. Get some. That's it, man.
Awesome, man. Jocko Willett, thanks so much, man.
Thanks, brother.
Appreciate you.